I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
Good evening and welcome to Amplify, a telephone talk show that looks at life from a religious perspective. I'm Father Ron Langwin, hoping that you have felt the warmth of God's love in your life this day, but especially the joy you feel when you share that love with others. I'd like to begin our program as we do each week with a story that is based on faith and formed with imagination, this on the eve, of Halloween. It had been a long and very difficult day. The crowds just didn't seem to understand what Jesus was trying to teach them. He was tired, hungry, and worn, so much so that Peter was concerned about him. He knew Jesus was weak from fasting and that he wanted to spend more time alone in prayer. But no matter where they went, someone was crying out in need, and so Jesus attended to them. Jesus walked a lot more slowly than usual, and so John said to Peter, "The master looks very tired. We must take him away someplace where he can rest." Simon and Judas called out to the crowd, "The master is tired now. He will see you later." Crying and wailing could be heard, but also cursing and laughter. "How can he possibly be tired?" one person asked. "After all, isn't he the son of a carpenter?" Jesus just ignored their complaints and slowly walked away. They had found peace in a friend's garden, but it was quickly broken by a loud, shrill cry and the foulest language Jesus had ever heard. A 9-year-old child stood in front of Jesus and cursed him. Jesus said firmly, "Be quiet. I am tired and do not want to hear what you are saying." The child moved back 3 steps, and her father walked up to Jesus and said, Master, her heart has been blackened. She speaks like one possessed. Where have I gone wrong? Have I not listened to your father's words and given to the poor?" Jesus answered, My friend, she has made her own choice. It was not a wise decision, for after listening to those who speak about the power of evil, she thought she would become stronger by following their ways. She did grow stronger, but not in the ways of my father. We are all free to make our own decisions, but those who have introduced her to evil will be judged for her pain and suffering. And when Jesus bent down, the child snapped at him with her teeth, biting him on the hand enough to draw blood. At that moment, a loud and hideous laugh came out of the girl, and she was freed from the bonds of darkness that had held her, and she began to cry. Looking at the teeth marks and blood on his hand, Jesus said, "All men have done this to me, and they will continue to do so until the end of time. They may leave their marks upon me, but I will place my mark upon them so that they can sit at my side forever." A story of faith and imagination. Our guest this evening writes in the preface to his latest book, titled The Exorcism Fouls, True Stories of Demonic Possession. It is human nature all the way back to Adam and Eve. We do not like to be told what to do. More than that, we are suspicious of anyone who says they know better than we do. When other people struggle at going it alone, we assume it is their problem and probably their own fault. We think we will not make the same mistakes, or we are simply stronger than they. So into the world we go, making our own choices, each of us reinventing the wheel. Of course, there are many who take advantage of this tendency towards willfulness and suspicion in order to shape our ideas and our views and to exploit the naivete for their own profit. Eventually, hopefully, life trades youth for wisdom, and we start to see the value in the rules of morality and propriety our forebears tried to pass down to us. We can see part of this fallen nature playing out in the secularization of our civilization, the warnings against sin and falsehoods, and especially the dark supernatural powers that exist in our world, that used to be baked into society, are no longer passed down. They are no longer reflected in our stories and traditions. Even the clergy these days are rarely trained in the reality of the spiritual world. Many Catholics, lay and clergy, are simply embarrassed to openly take the spiritual seriously. We have wandered away from our spiritual traditions and forgotten the lessons from millennia of experience. Though we may have left behind the supernatural, it has not left us behind. Religion used to provide answers and rituals to help us understand the things we cannot understand with only our wits and our senses. Now, increasingly, we search for answers in ways previous generations knew to be dangerous. And so we play with spiritual forces we do not understand and cannot control. This book is not about telling you what to do or not to do, least in the sense of a collection of rules. We know that does not cut it in today's world. Instead, this book is about telling stories, real stories, my stories, about the reality of the spiritual world and the dark forces that move about in that world and influence this one. These stories may not prove the old warnings and lessons about the spiritual world in a strictly scientific way, but my hope is that they will demonstrate the wisdom of the past and make the intangible feel maybe for the first time real. The author of these words and our guest this evening is Adam Bly, who's been with us before. He spent about 15 years learning about the brain, mental illness, and forensic psychology. He then spent more than 15 years assisting the exorcism ministry in the United States and elsewhere. He is an expert on religious demonology and exorcism for our Diocese of Pittsburgh and has taught priests and seminarians across the country. After being at hundreds of solemn exorcisms and working on thousands of demonic cases in some way, he has learned the ways people get into trouble. Now, part of his work is informing the public about these things so they can choose whether to avoid them. In addition to seeing spiritual evil, he has seen spiritual good in the form of miracles and other extraordinary graces. Adam Bly, welcome to Amplify. Did I drop him off? Oh, and I could have hit. Oh, Adam? Nice to have you back again.
Hi, Father. There, I couldn't hear you.
That's okay. That's fine. As you do in the book, tell us a little bit of some of the background information about the focus of your book. I did part of that in introduction, but the troublesome, deceptive spirits that humankind has had to deal with.
Yes. So the purpose of the book is to share cautionary stories, as you shared in the reading at the introduction. And these spirits are basically the fallen angels that we have quite a good understanding of within Catholic Christianity. The difficulty is they don't present as fallen angels. They present as helpful spirits or the dead or even a holy angel to deceive people.
Yes. And this evening, I've I'd like, if you agree, not so much to tell the stories, because I'd like people to get the book and be able to read all the stories, but to talk about the evils that exist that are a part of each of the stories. But if at any point you want to tell part of the story, certainly feel free to do that, okay?
Yes, Father.
What then is an exorcism for those who don't understand?
Before I start, Father, maybe your engineer could check. I'm hearing a loud repeat of myself.
Yeah, okay. He's checking.
Okay, thank you. So an exorcism, of course, goes back to what Jesus demonstrated for us in the gospel.
Let me ask you, is that better? Is that better?
Yes.
Did we correct it? Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. So when we say an exorcism, most people, I think, imagine what they've seen in the movies. You know, a dramatic scene with a priest or two and a possessed person. But the church really has a number of different types of exorcism that she does. All of these are done with the authority of Jesus that he gave the church, and because he ordered the church to go and do these things. And so a solemn exorcism is when the church prays over a possessed person. And that's what people think of, and that's what they've seen in movies and TV shows. But there's also minor exorcisms for homes and objects. There is a optional exorcism in the baptism rite because of the assumption of original sin being present in all of creation. And within the RCIA process of entering the church, there still is some very limited exorcisms there. We're not presuming those people are possessed, but mm-hmm. those are prayers commanding the evil spirits to leave that person and leave them alone.
And there are about four classic signs. Well, tell us about the four classic signs of possession.
Sure. So the church is very cautious about deciding that a person is possessed and moving forward with an exorcism. So the church requires an outside medical evaluation or psychological evaluation first, and that person, that doctor, doesn't diagnose the possession. They just tell the church whether the symptoms can be explained by a known diagnosis and be treated. Then the church goes in and discerns the spiritual signs of possession, and that is knowledge of all languages, which schizophrenia doesn't make you suddenly fluent in ancient languages, mm-hmm. knowledge of hidden things, such as the sins of the people that are there in the room, or sometimes even mundane things from their life, but very specific that that person couldn't possibly know. Thirdly, detecting the holy. They can tell you if something is blessed or not, even when it's not obvious, like a regular bottle of water, whether a box has a relic in it or not, that type of thing. And then finally, strength beyond their condition in life. And that's kind of a supernatural strength where they're much stronger than you would expect them to be, and they don't seem to ever tire.
Now, there are four parts to your book. Part one is an introduction to another world, and you describe it as one in which you discover the reality of the dynamic through the fakeness of reality TV and see things I never expected. And chapter one is about modern spiritualism and the paranormal TV craze. So tell us a little bit about spiritualism and the surge of interest in communicating with the dead.
So spiritualism is basically a pursuit of necromancy or communicating with the dead. It has, in our country, there tends to be a big interest in that after world wars, when a lot of people have lost loved ones, lost children, they're greatly bereaved, and they're desperate for any connection with them or comfort about their afterlife or where they might be. And so it originally, spiritualism really started in the West in the late 1800s with the Fox sisters in New York, who were basically scamming their parents, and they later confessed that they were using a string and an apple to make the knocks in the house. But everybody believed them for many, many years, and they made a career out of it, and it spread across Europe and across the United States. Got big after World War I, big after World War II, and in those times it was mostly Ouija boards and mediums and table tipping were incredibly popular. And then it kind of faded out in the 50s and 60s. But then in the 60s, we saw kind of a surge in interest in the darker side, the more openly dark side of witchcraft and Satanism through a lot of movies and things like that. And then what we've seen now in our generation is a revival of spiritualism, but now instead of a Ouija board or a pendulum or table tipping, it's done with digital recorders and other electronic devices.
And you write how that television started a new era of interest.
Yes, for sure. So before the paranormal TV kind of craze started, it was not a normal thing to be a paranormal investigator. That would be a very odd thing that people wouldn't accept or celebrate or have web pages about or be on TV about. And this kind of burst onto the scene, and now there are dozens of paranormal TV shows with very similar formats pursuing various things, and more recently, more openly pursuing demonic infestations, because it seems the interest of the public has dulled a little bit to the ghosts, and so now a lot of these shows talk about demons more than ghosts.
And in this first chapter, you talk a little bit about hypnosis as one of the last real mysteries of psychology and brain science, and you're not a big fan of it, believing it's better to work with the conscious mind than the unconscious, and then about Wicca and witchcraft, and which is recognized as a legitimate religion without any structure of beliefs. And you also talk about praying for deliverance. And as you conclude the first part, you have a kind of summary, and you indicate that all of the things we would talked about partially, and again, I'm going to let people buy the book so they can read the stories. They're absolutely fascinating. Most people want to read the stories rather than hear about the evil itself. But you write that it ended up by leading me on a surprising path to exorcisms that has defined your life. And there was a point in my life when I was a part of that with you also. So we're going to take this first break, and then when we come back, we'll continue our discussion.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We get it. Attention spans just aren't what they used to be. Heads in social media and eyes on Netflix. But what do people do with their ears? Well, for one, they're listening to audio. Americans spend 4.4 hours with audio every day. Oh, and you want the proof? Well, you just sat through this ad that's now approaching 30 seconds. What could you say to a potential customer in 30 seconds? Let Odyssey put together a media plan tailor-made for your unique marketing needs. Advertise with Odyssey. Visit ads.odyssey.com.
Welcome back to Amplify, where our guest is Adam Bly. He's written a book titled The Exorcism Files. It's four parts of how he got involved, up to a point that it became a matter of life or death for him. He is now an expert on religious demonology and exorcism. Adam, I didn't like the way that I conducted the first part of the program. Why don't you, as we now begin to talk about part two, just say a couple of sentences about what this story is about, so we can pick their interest just a little bit. Okay, that sounds all right.
Sure. Sure. You mean the stories in the book in
the
general?
The stories in the book, yes. Yeah, the ones during, like we're going to start talking about part two now, learning the roots. And the first chapter is six. And the question I would have to ask is it possible to sell our soul to the devil? And indeed, you have a story where that happened.
Yes. So in this part of the book, I was encountering a lot of things for the first time. And there's certain themes and ideas that have been repeated in the cases over the years. But this was in the early years of this work for me. And so everything was a new discovery. And the idea of selling your soul, I don't think that part is so much attractive to people as the idea of a shortcut to power or competency or something that people want in life. And the idea of a shortcut and getting what you want quickly through appealing to the devil or the demons, when somebody's, I think, disenfranchised and feeling like life isn't working out, perhaps becomes a real option. And there was a story where a young man did a ritual. He was coached in it actually by a relative of his who was in a satanic coven, and they did a ritual to, as kind of corny as it sounds, this really happened, to play the guitar well and get a gig playing with a major band.
Right.
They bargained for facility with the guitar and good times and women, and they got a certain number of years, and then everything fell apart, and they were destitute and back at home with their family and possessed and literally unable to eat, though the doctors had looked at them many times. Couldn't find any reason they couldn't eat. If they did force something down, unfortunately, they couldn't keep it down. And eventually, by the time I met him, he had lost about 100 pounds, and he looked like a skeleton. He looks like he was dying, because he was. And it was a blessedly quick liberation for him. I think God did it quickly because he was close to dead. And if it had gone on too long, he probably wouldn't have lasted. Now, the idea, Father, of being able to sell your soul, you can't really, because your soul isn't yours to sell. Your soul is God's, and God judges us when we die, and he decides where we go. So if a person were to die even possessed, they would still go to their judgment just like everybody else, and God would then determine what to do with their soul.
In part two, then, you talk about the divining rods, a modern version of what water witches used to do with a forked stick, and then a psychic kid. What is meant by psychic sensitivity, and what is the power of blessing a house?
Well, you know, psychic sensitivity is a difficult thing. So the older exorcist in Rome that I learned from through the International Association in our meetings there, they would sometimes talk about two different types of gifts. Now, these are the ones that are from God, not from the demons. And one would be a charism, and that's kind of a spiritual ability that's given to do ministry. Like perhaps a priest might have a real charism for confession, and they're just wonderful in that sacrament. They have, you know, unusual insight into the person's soul. They're a great counselor, and people are drawn to them for confession. That would be a charism. And there can be sensitivity to spirits that is a charism, but it's there for ministry. And in my experience, it's active when we're doing ministry. It's not just there all the time that we walk around and are sensitive to things. Now, they would also talk about things that they would call natural gifts. And this isn't really something you'll find in the church's formal teaching. It's not heretical, but it's the idea that they've noticed that some gifts run in families and some sensitivity to spirit seems to run in families. And it's not necessarily there as a charism. And it does seem to be more just active most of the time. Now, the great difficulty, Father, is that the demons can give a false version of this and make the person think that they have great gifts and they're very important spiritually. And that's what some of the stories in the book are about, and trying to discern between something from God and something from the evil one. And, you know, to skip to the punchline of that, when in doubt, ask Jesus to take anything that's not of him away, and make that a sincere prayer. And that's a very effective way to discern between gifts from God and gifts from the devil.
And the use of holy oil and the litany of the saints.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the application of prayer in the context where these gifts might be active or sacramentals can also help with that. Yes.
And this was a story about a child featured on a TV show about kids with supposed psychic abilities. That became one of your cases. And the little girl had negative experiences of what she thought were spirits most of her life. And as you said, psychic sensitivity seemed to run in the family and was normal to them. So we're not going to tell the whole story, but certainly the book has all these fascinating stories, and the very things we're talking about, everything we're talking about is in the book without the full story. Chapter 9 is Coward. What is the significance of the title of this story, Coward?
Well, this was an intense, very quick and intense case. I had gone up into one of the boroughs of New York City. I don't remember how the family contacted me. It was through somebody else. And I went up there on my own just to look into the case as best I could. And there was a nephew who was living in the back room of one of the apartments the family owned, who was involved in Wicca. Or at least that's what he told his mother. Now, they had me come when he was at work. This was at like 1 p.m, and he was on an afternoon shift at his job. He was going to be there till 7 or 8 p.m. I don't remember. And we were praying together and, praying a blessing, asking Jesus to bless the house, these type of things, and also just discussing this. And in the middle of praying the Our Father, I heard the door kind of slam open behind me in the apartment, and this man, young man, basically was stomping past me. And as he passed me, he never touched me, but he leaned over and whispered harshly in my ear, "Coward," and went into his room and slammed the door, and it sounded like he started smashing the furniture in his room and throwing things against the walls, but he never came out. So, and we just kept praying, of course. But it was one of the early examples of that the demons had in some way let him know what was going on, and I guess told him or compelled him to leave work and try to interfere with what was happening.
And you've been involved in hundreds of cases, and there are times, aren't there, when you don't know the end of the story?
Sure. There's many times that people ask us for assistance in some, with some difficulty. Sometimes we just give some advice. Sometimes we visit with them. Sometimes they come and meet us at a church for prayer. And in a lot of cases, we just don't hear from them again. Sometimes, often it's resolved and they just don't call us back or communicate, and then some people get spooked. They get harmed or punished by what they're attached to, these evil spirits, and they decide to avoid that punishment. And instead of pushing forward towards God, they back off in deference to the demon. And those people sometimes make that choice and they disappear too.
And now we get to part 3 of part 4 of the book. And it's titled The Big Leagues. And you describe it as one in which I begin to advise during solemn exorcisms, get to know several demons, and see just about everything they're capable of. What does it mean to get to know several demons?
Well, unfortunately, with the higher ranked ones, and as your listeners may know, there's 9 choirs of angels are described in the Bible, and we're pretty sure that some fell from all choirs. So there seems to be about 9 ranks of the demonic. So with the higher ranked ones, you run into the same ones over and over. And these are names that one would recognize from the Old Testament, sometimes the New Testament, Book of Revelations. And these same 5 or 6 are often the last demons cast out in a case. I just refer to them as generals under Satan. They kind of seem to be one rank below him. And he rarely fights for a case himself. I've only seen that twice. So these same 5 or 6 names keep coming up, and you meet them in different cases in different cities, different states across the country. And after meeting them so many times, regardless of what person they're in, they personally recognize us,
mm-hmm.
you know, make comments about, oh, I haven't seen you such and such over in this other state, you know, 3 months ago or whatever it was. And, we get used to them and the way they speak. You can recognize them pretty quickly, even if they don't give their name. And that's one of the kind of, I would say, more personally eerie things about being deeply involved in this, is that it's very clear that you're on the radar with the guys downstairs. And they're very interested in the lives of the people that are trying to actively oppose them and expose their tricks.
And the rite, essentially, you write, has 3 phases: prayers to agitate and wear the demon down, interrogations to get answers to questions, and adjurations to command it to leave the person. So actually try to agitate a demon.
Yes, because the demons want to stay hidden and avoid confronting the exorcist, confronting the church, and because they know there's no win. There's no win for them. They're merely creatures. God has created everything, including them, and they know there's no win for them. So they would try to just avoid manifesting and being present entirely if they could, because then they would just avoid the fight that they can't win. And so some of the prayers, like the Litany of the Saints, is a beautiful prayer of the church and does a great job at causing such spiritual distress to the demon that it shows itself out of kind of its distress. It's kind of forced forward to show itself. And beyond that, a lot of the prayers in the rite of exorcism are there to kind of spiritually wear them down. Gospel readings, the Psalms are particularly effective. Certain segments of the text remind the demon of its fallen state and what it gave up, and that it's nothing but evil. All of these things kind of enrage them and force them to show themselves so that they can then be interrogated and cast out.
And the title of this particular chapter is Welcome to the Big Time, Kid. So who might be included in the team conducting an exorcism? Is an exorcist ever alone?
No, never. Never. There's usually at least one additional priest, maybe two. Ideally, there's a second exorcist, so the main exorcist can take breaks and the prayers can continue because, you know, especially after an hour or so standing and, you know, praying forcefully, it can be good to take a break. And then, of course, we always have very kind of devout and reliable witnesses, usually 2 or 3 women, there to pray rosaries and observe everything. So the exorcist is never alone with the person at any time. And we always have those witnesses present. Now, in addition, Father, part of the wonderful work that we're able to do here in our diocese is we have priests in from other neighboring dioceses that are in training that will come in to sit in and observe and be trained, you know, by watching the work be done and also by participating in it.
And what kind of qualifications are necessary for an exorcist?
Well, the church says the bishop should pick somebody who's mature, who is well known to the bishop, who is of good and known solid moral character, is not at all seeking aggrandizement or attention, and is basically very stable. And so you get the feeling in reading various documents in the church that the church figured out you want somebody very salt of the earth and straightforward and grounded in prayer, not particularly interested in interesting and new thoughts and ideas and experimenting with theology, but somebody that is just very grounded and obedient and will stick to the right, because the demons are active and tricky adversaries that try to draw the exorcist into new theologies and experimental prayers and all kinds of deviations from the rite.
Is there a difference then between the old rite and the new rite?
Yes, there are differences. The new rite, which was originally written in 1998 and then went through a bunch of revisions, the main difference with that new rite compared to the 1614 rite, which is the old one, is that the new rite is primarily centered around the baptismal promises and essentially asks the Holy Spirit through the baptismal graces to cast the demon out. And what they did is they then included as optional prayers some of the more combative and direct commands that were more in the style of the old rite. They then included those as optional prayers. And so it became more of a less active and aggressive prayer. And then they rolled some of the more combative language back into it. But it is essentially now the same, though the new rite is shorter.
Mm-hmm. What is it that you mean by combative language?
Well, for instance, things like, in the name of Jesus Christ, I command you to leave this person. That's what the technical term we would call an imprecatory prayer. It's a direct command versus, Lord, please free this person of this problem, is a request to God. It doesn't directly challenge the demon. And so those two things are qualitatively different and actually extremely important. And the church figured out many centuries ago that the direct command to the demon to do anything, because that is a personal challenge between the exorcist and the demon, that type of prayer needs to be done with the apostolic authority behind it, meaning the bishop's authority has been given to that priest, and that priest has the bishop's permission to say these prayers. And what we see, Father, is that the demon basically does not obey until the bishop's authority is behind the prayers. And I think that's because if we read the gospel carefully, Jesus gave the full authority to the apostles over the demons and some authority to the 72, to the people, but the primary authority and the full authority to the apostles. And so until the exorcist has that authority backing him up, those direct commands basically just get the demon angry, and it will say things like, mm-hmm. You don't have authority over me. I don't have to listen to you.
And what are some of the things that might happen at an exorcism?
Well, in terms of the demon's activity, they will, yell at us. Colloquial way would be to say trash talk us, insult us, mock us. I've had many times try to bite, gouge with nails, break your bones, kick at your knees, any kind of violence, choking. It can be, depending on the case, it can be a very physical attack. But interestingly, what we see many times is at the beginning of that particular session, the demon will say, Jesus told me I'm not allowed to touch Father so-and-so or Father so-and-so because they're older, but I'm allowed to fight you and you because you're young. And then it will proceed to not lay a finger and not even get near the older priests that Jesus has told them are off limits. And so even though it can be violent, it's still within what God allows. And so in spite of all the violence and the supernatural strength in all these years, I've never been seriously hurt nor seen anybody else seriously hurt.
And I'm going to read us out to our next break. You write in the interrogation part, the questions are limited to who the demon is, how the demon and his associates got in the person, and when Jesus had decreed that they will leave. Any further questioning would be for the sake of curiosity, not for the good of the possessed, and so is not allowed. Further, anything outside of what is prescribed by the church does not carry the church's authority, so the demon can lie and use the questioning to draw the interrogator into deceptions. The reason the demons have to answer truthfully to the authorized questions, even though they are liars by nature, is the authority Jesus gave his church over demons. So our guest this evening is Adam Bly. We're talking about his book, The Exorcism Files.
Now, with the MLB app, you can get baseball your way. Pick your favorite team, your favorite players, and get customized highlights, stories, and breaking news right on your home feed. Follow the action with Game Tip, where 3D replays add another dimension. Plus, notifications can keep you connected to every pitch, every hit, every game. The MLB app. Baseball, your way. Download it now for free from the App Store or Google Play. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.